Akron Mayor Shamus Mollick gave his first State of the City address yesterday, marking his first 100 days in office. He touted the work that's been done, claiming 55 of the 73 action items on his list of goals, including working on more transparency, communication, and engagement, have been checked off. He also acknowledged the work that needs to be done when it comes to building trust in police. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll talk to IdeaStream, Akron Canton reporter Anna Huntsman, and Mayor Shamus Mollick himself about the work that's been done, and we'll hear about his new search for a police chief, where it currently stands, and why it's been criticized by other city leaders. Later, we'll talk to bartender Tony Cost about his journey to sobriety and how he's helping others deal with their own substance abuse. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us on this Thursday. Last night, Akron Mayor Shamus Mollick gave his first State of the City address. It marked his 100th day in office, as well as Mollick's 33rd birthday. The mayor struck a hopeful tone, touting his administration's accomplishments in the area of transparency, communication, and engagement. He also discussed modernizing the operation of City Hall, and he drilled into the city's budget. But while Mollick spoke to Akron's recent successes, he also noted that the city is experiencing some big challenges, particularly when it comes to the city's police department, the trust by the public of those police officers, and public safety issues. A familiar refrain for a city that wrestled with the shooting death of Jaylen Walker back in the summer of 2022. The city of Akron is currently undergoing a search for a new police chief, and it's causing friction with other city leaders. The city also recently released body cam footage of another officer-involved shooting from last week that left a 15-year-old injured. To begin our show today, we'll be looking back at Mollick's first State of the City address. We'll talk about a search for a new police chief, and we'll talk about that shooting last week. Later in the hour, stick around as we bring you a conversation with Tony Cost, a longtime service industry worker who's been vocal about his journey to sobriety, all while continuing to serve drinks behind a bar. Finally, we discuss a new book from best-selling author James Patterson. It's not another crime novel or thriller. This one focuses on librarians and booksellers. But first, here with me now to discuss the latest happenings in Akron is IdeaStream Public Media Akron Canton reporter Anna Huntsman. Anna, thanks for making the drive in.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And we should note we are also expecting to be joined by Mayor Shamus Mollick shortly. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, give us a call. 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Okay, so Anna, let's quickly get your impression on Mollick's State of the City. You've been covering him as a city council person, as he was running for mayor. The tone of the address, do you think it stayed in that same tenor that he had on the campaign trail?
I would say yes in many ways, because he's always having this very positive and progressive message and wanting to bring about change. He's always talking about how much he loves the city and wants to make it better, pointing out the issues that it's facing. I think what I'm hearing now, though, is I think reality is setting in. I think the reality of there have been a couple things so far. For example, he talked about how getting the budget passed was not the most fun process. He kind of went back and forth with city council. He had all these grand plans of wanting to hire a bunch of new staff and people focused on these specific initiatives that he talked about throughout the campaign and that he's really passionate about. But there was pushback from council wanting that money to be spent elsewhere, not just in his kind of cabinet and senior manager. So that was something that kind of a roadblock, if you will, that he hit. Now the city has had another officer-involved shooting, and it was a teenager. That's happening. And then there's also this whole police chief debacle, which I know we're going to talk about here today. But, you know, that was one of the first things on his plate when he started as mayor, is getting a new police chief. And then it kind of didn't go the way he thought.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So the city is looking for a new chief. Originally, Mayor Mollick announced a nationwide search, and this was similar to past searches, mm-hmm. but that didn't last long. So give us a refresher of what kind of happened that made the mayor realize, I am looking for potentially external candidates from all across the country.
Yep.
And then I am limited to maybe looking at candidates from within the department.
Yeah, so a few months ago, very early in his time as mayor, he had this big community forum wanting to hear from the public, what do you want in the next police chief? There was a survey. People could give comments directly to him. He was on the stage, and he's talking about, here's what we're looking for. We want to cast the widest net possible. That's what he was saying. So then imagine my surprise as a reporter and the surprise of many other people when a little while later we go to this press conference and he says, actually, we found out that we can only hire internal candidates. We can't cast the widest net possible. We can't look across the nation. And that's because of a provision in the Ohio Revised Code that, in his interpretation and the law department's interpretation, basically says that the new leaders must come through promotion. So, and there's set parameters for who can apply. So if the top ranking officers apply, they can't go to the next rank of captains. So he says this, and immediately what was kind of on the mind of many of us reporters in the room is who are the top-ranking officers, and it's two people, two white men, Brian Harding and Jesse Leeser. They're both deputy chiefs. So in this city that has had this, you know, racial reckoning in the past few years with the fatal shooting, police shooting of Jalen Walker, a young black man, there's been calls for police reform. The city voted to have a police oversight board.
Sure.
It's kind of, you know, these are huge issues. And then, boom, you can't look for the most diverse candidates, essentially. And Malik has said this was frustrating, that he wanted to cast the widest net possible. He says he respects, you know, the choices. He's very happy with the two deputy chiefs, but he's frustrated. He continues to say he's frustrated, and other people are frustrated too.
Well, and those other people, the black elected officials of Summit County, they've been one of the biggest critics of this search process, and they want to halt the whole police search altogether. Isn't that right?
Great point, Jenny. Yes, exactly. So because of what Malik says is the limits of the state law, he says, well, why don't we do a charter amendment this fall where we can get it on our books in the city that we can hire anybody, we can appoint an external candidate. Let's, you know, but he's saying we can't wait until then. So we'll fix it for the future. But for now, we got to keep going with this search. Whereas, as you mentioned, this group, the black elected officials, which includes some council members, other, you know, state senators, things like that, they're saying, no, halt the search. Let's continue with the interim chief, Brian Harding, and wait until that charter amendment is, you know, potentially passed. And then let's reopen the search, hoping to get a more diverse pool of candidates. That's what they want. But he continues to say that he feels that it's better in the long run to not wait.
So is the idea this, that if you really want to garner public trust in the police department, you want to change the culture and the character of a police department, that you need to infuse new energy, and also maybe just you need the face of the police chief to be reflective of, you know, there's a big black community in Akron, and maybe it's time for a black police chief to speak as candidly as possible.
That is exactly what they're saying, is that you want someone who represents the community. Again, as you mentioned, you know, the black population in the city is saying we need somebody who looks like us and understands, you know, what we go through. But yeah, the other point is, you know, Brian Harding and Jesse Leeser have been with the department for a long time. And if you're trying to make a cultural shift, again, this is what the black elected officials are saying, let's look elsewhere. Let's not necessarily just go with the internal candidates if we really want to have this shift.
We have Akron Mayor Shamus Malik on the phone. Mayor, I appreciate you making the call this morning and joining us on The Sound of Ideas. Good morning.
Absolutely. Glad to be with you.
All right. We're just going to get to the stuff about the police chief right now, since we're on the topic. And then I would love to talk with you more about your State of the City address and some of the accomplishments you touted. So as Anna was just talking about, the police chief search has become controversial. And you have gotten some criticism from the black elected officials of Summit County because of kind of the change in approach. You know, you campaigned on the fact that the police department needed to garner trust from the public, and that there needed to be a change, maybe both energetically and characteristically within the department. But that now seems to be different when it comes to your search for a police chief.
Well, so let me be, you know, very clear. There are lots of ways in which we need change in how our police department operates. And, you know, I'm just as committed to those as ever. The issue that we've had, right, is that last fall, based on the past practice of the city, we started a search that allowed for external candidates. It allowed for internal candidates who are below the rank of deputy chief down to sergeants, lieutenants, captains. And again, we're doing this based on the past practice of the city. Upon coming into office in January, our law department came to us and they had been looking into an unrelated issue about our fire chief. And in looking at state law, but also looking at our city charter, the city constitution, they said, we do not have the authority to have that external search. We don't have the authority to consider candidates below deputy chief if they apply. And so at that point, my choice is whether I can pause the search and work to amend our charter, or I can continue the search with the internal candidates we have, who I respect deeply. It's incredibly frustrating to me because there is so much change that's needed. And it's change that has to happen. In my determination, change can best happen with a permanent chief who's driving forward a vision, who's at the negotiating table with the police union this year, who's able to help us get policy change done and other changes done. And so that's why we're moving forward. I understand the concerns. I've had many conversations. Every day I have conversations with folks, and I'm not hiding from that, and I'm not asking folks to agree with me, but we are just as committed to change as ever. Last night, and I apologize, I'm going on and on, but last night we unveiled a change to our vehicle pursuit policy.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
You know, so at effective 7 a.m. this morning, we will no longer have vehicle chases solely for equipment violations like a broken taillight, broken side mirror. That comes out of the department doing its own review of that policy. We're going to be reviewing other policies in the weeks and months to come. The same thing with our Summit County Outreach Team, which is a new program with Akron Fire, Akron Police, and mental health providers, where we're now sending out that team to certain mental health calls where it's safe and effective to do so. Our police auditor is now in place this month, and we're beginning to work with him on how that office is going to function, especially in light of the officer-involved shooting we had. And we released more information about that shooting than we're required to by law, so the community could see the full context. We released the personnel file. We didn't redact the officer name because we didn't feel it was appropriate, absent specific threats. And so I want folks to know I'm just as committed to change as ever. What I'm doing is I'm giving you my best judgment that the best way to have change is by having a permanent chief, not having an acting chief in place for a year while we wait to amend the charter.
So, Mayor, I hear you clearly. My understanding is that when Stephen Milette stepped down, he had been from Bellevue, Washington. So were the codes not honored previously, and somehow the understanding of policy that must be adhered to surfaced and became obviously a sticking point in your search?
Yeah, there have been two police chiefs hired previously who are external. The first was Chief Nice. And then Chief Milette. And again, I'm not going to get into how previous administrations interpreted the charter. I'm not aware of, you know, I wasn't in the room when they were making those determinations, or even if they were aware of the provisions, it's not for me to say. What I can say is that upon looking at our city charter, which is our city constitution, and looking at state law, they don't conflict and they're fairly clear. And so we're going to continue to share the details of that, you know, with the public. I did as soon as I had our I's dotted and T's crossed in the legal analysis in early March. But we're going to continue to share that. But for me, it's fairly clear. And so I'm committed to bringing a charter amendment this fall that would change that process in our city charter going forward for police and fire, for the chief searches and deputy chief searches. But I don't feel it's appropriate to wait until November. But I'm a lawyer. You know, I'm always going to, you know, show fidelity to the law. And if our law department and outside counsel say this is the best interpretation of our city charter, I have to follow that. I can't just say I disagree, especially when I look at the legal reasoning and I can't find fault with it either.
So since I have you on the line, the definitive final answer to this is, despite the Black elected officials of Summit County saying, let's pause this search and wait till we can get this charter amendment in place so we can broaden the search nationwide and try to get a more kind of diverse pool of candidates, are you going to go with the two deputy chiefs that have already been listed and kind of named as the primary candidates?
We have candidate forums scheduled for April 20th and April 23rd over at Bookdale High School. We are going to move forward with that process. I'm continuing to engage with folks and listen and talk and be in dialogue with folks. There are lots of different ways in which we can work quickly to improve the diversity in our APD leadership and Akron Fire leadership in every department across the city. But I've been very clear. I went to a town hall two nights ago at Bookdale High School where I, addressed and I listened to folks and I addressed these concerns head on. But we are going to continue with this process. That's my best judgment of what will help move our city forward. It's not a, to me, necessarily an either or. There's absolutely an opportunity to work on many different things that will help improve the diversity of our department. And that's my obligation. If I don't accomplish that, if we don't have substantial improvement in the diversity of all leadership, not just one role, that will be my failure to own as well. And so I take it very seriously.
Anna, you have a question for the mayor?
Yeah. Hi, Mayor Mollick. Anna Huntsman here.
Hi, Anna.
Just a quick question for you. As you're talking about this and saying you are going to continue to move forward, you don't want to wait to have that charter amendment. I'm just curious, to those who say that you should wait, what in your mind in the next 6 or 7 months, assuming you go ahead and hire the chief, how is that different than if you would wait and then have this charter amendment? Like, what could somebody in the next 6 or 7 months really start accomplishing? Like, that's something I've heard from people. So I wanted to put that question to you.
No, I get it. I think that it's one thing to have a acting chief for a couple of months while you do a search. It's another thing to have an acting chief for well over a year. And we're talking about an organization of several hundred people. And to have that kind of uncertainty for that length of time is difficult. And it's difficult then for me to take public safety and my priorities, which I've said are our highest priority of this administration, and to then start really moving them through a system when we have that level of uncertainty, right? There are so many things, and a lot of it is when we talk about improving the diversity of the department, improving the hiring process, things that need to be negotiated in our union negotiations this summer and fall. And do we want to go to that table with someone who, may not be there in a few months as the chief? Or do we want to go in there with someone who's the chief who can lead on their vision and on the way they want to push for changes? The same thing is true when it comes to policies. The same thing is true when it comes to initiatives like community policing. We need a leader who can kind of fully act with the authority of a chief. And an acting chief can in a capacity. But, if you say, we're going to have an acting chief for well over a year, I think that it begins to undermine the institution. And that's, again, what I'm saying is, as I'm sitting here today, that's my best judgment as the person who's been elected to sit in the chair. I'm not saying that everyone has to agree with me, but that's my best judgment. I was elected to give people my best judgment. And so it's not a question of whether we have change or not. It's a question of how best to achieve that change. And so that's where that rationale comes from.
If you have a question for the mayor, you can give us a call toll-free, 866-578-0903, or you can email us at soi@ideastream.org. Mayor, I want to ask you about the officer-involved shooting with a 15-year-old who was holding a replica gun. What is your reaction to that, and what is the city's position when it comes to investigating what happened?
So it's a tragic situation. I was out there that night. I was having dinner. I saw that this happened, and I, went out there on the scene, and I'm very, very grateful that the teenager was not more seriously injured. I'm glad that the officer is okay. But these incidents are the hardest things for our community to grapple with. And so, we worked to release the body camera footage. again, beyond what was required by city law. And it shows the interaction after the shooting. And, you know, the young man is saying, you know, a number of things like he felt unsafe. And, you know, I think these are things that we as a community need to grapple with. When it comes to the investigation, you know, again, as a lawyer, as a process-oriented person, this is why we put Issue 10 in place, that, you know, when we have these deadly force incidents or critical incidents, there's a process. So the Ohio BCI is investigating. They were on the scene when I was out there two Monday nights ago. And then there will be an internal investigation, and it will be shared as well with our police auditor. And so, you know, this is how the process will unfold. We did share the personnel file of the officer, and we anticipate being able to share more information in the coming weeks. And I have an obligation, you know, not to prejudge these kinds of situations or not to, you know, get ahead of the process, but it's very incumbent and urgent upon me that we address situations like this. And so, you know, part of the vehicle pursuit policy change is an effort to address tragedies proactively to try to get ahead of some of these things. But I, you know, this is perhaps the most important thing that I will work on, is some of these life and death situations like this.
Mayor, you talked last night of the 55 of the 73 items on your 100-day agenda that in your mind had been fulfilled or checked off in some capacity. Why don't you tell us about some of the other highlights of the work that you feel the administration has accomplished in the last 100 days?
Well, I'm really excited about the work that we've done. I think we've been able to get an awful lot done in 100 days. Not that in many cases, almost all the priorities will continue in one form or another, but we completed what we thought we could get done in 100 days, right? So, you know, we didn't decide on the next location for the police station, but we did put out the RFP. We got 8 different proposals from that process. We have, I think, 4 internal city proposals. And so now we've got 12 proposals in front of us. By the end of June, we will have a decision on the future of the police station building, which has been a long time coming. It's much needed. We've modernized city operations. We released our snowplow tracker app. We released the 311 app, and we're continuing to kind of share that and grow that outreach. We're doing a lot to build our team, and we passed the capital budget. We passed an operating budget. We really centered public safety in there. We centered fiscal responsibility. But, you know, across the board, we've made a lot of progress. We unveiled last night a new community violence intervention program that we're going to start this summer. Because while, you know, we absolutely have to tackle gun violence through policing, we can't police our way out of these problems solely. And so we're working to unveil this credible messenger program this summer, where we'll train folks who have lived experience with the criminal justice system to go out in the community and interact with young people who might be on the road towards violence and help head them off on that life. So there's a lot of things that I'm proud of. We have an amazing team in City Hall, 2,000 people who I'm just so proud of every day. So I'm really excited about what we've been able to do in the 100 days, and now we got the work ahead of us.
Last night, you spoke about your intent to have participatory budgeting be a part of the city's budget next year. You know, we did a lot of coverage about the Cleveland attempt to get participatory budgeting implemented, and there was a lot of pushback from council members saying that, you know, essentially they are the elected representatives of the public's will, and so you know, diverting money from what they say the needs are is a little bit undermining. So what are your thoughts on how this can better serve the Akron communities?
You know, I think that we're going to take lessons from that Cleveland situation, which I'm very familiar with, and apply them here in Akron. And so it doesn't need to be an either or. It doesn't have to be zero sum. I think that participatory budgeting can be a process that evolves and builds over time. You know, participatory budgeting CLE has been an effort that's been years in the making. And so, you know, we held a town hall about our operating budget this year, and we had a lot of conversation, and a lot of the council members were there. We talked about the budget at council members' town halls. You know, we'd like to work constructively with council to build out what this looks like. You know, when we think about one of the things we've thought about is that it's easiest to see this with capital budget because we're investing in specific projects in neighborhoods. And so it'd be easy to have a day or a week where folks go to their local rec center and you know, there's 10 different items on the board and they say, hey, you know, we really want to prioritize this one. And that council member then has that feedback. But it could look a lot of different ways. And so I think we're at the beginning of that process, but we clearly committed last night. We will have some form of participatory budgeting, whether that's from the administration side, working in partnership with council. We'll get all those details.
Anna, we have 30 seconds left. So why don't you tell me how you're going to be following the mayor and what's going on in Akron?
Absolutely. There's a forum tomorrow continuing to talk about the officer-involved shooting. We'll be there covering. I'm there every week at City Council. I'm there at all the press conferences as well. It's what we do here, so we'll definitely be keeping an eye on it.
Anna Huntsman, Akron-Canton reporter here at IdeaStream Public Media, and Shamus Mollick, mayor of the city of Akron. You two have a shared birthday, so happy birthday
belated.
To both of you. Belated. And
wow,
to your...
I forgot that, Anna.
Yeah,
happy
so,
yeah, happy
so
belated.
Kindred spirits in some respects. Thanks to both of you for being on this morning. Thank you so much, Mayor.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, folks. Take care.
Time now for a quick break. On the other side, a conversation about sobriety and the service industry community. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us this hour. Most people aren't surrounded by alcohol during their job, but that's not the case for many service industry workers. Waiters, waitresses, bartenders, and barbacks are pouring and serving drinks constantly. And because of the hours and settings these workers are in, the after-work drink is often the time to hang out and unwind. But that combination of the active, high-stress, and high-pressure profession, the odd hours, as well as being surrounded by alcohol, can have some dangerous ramifications. According to a 2015 study by Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, the food service and hospitality industry has the highest rates of substance use disorders and third highest rate of heavy alcohol use of all employment sectors. There are some individuals out there that are looking to buck that trend and offer a helping hand to their coworkers who might be wrestling with addiction. Groups like Ben's Friends, Big Table, and The Giving Kitchen all provide help in the service industry space. Now I'd like to welcome Tony Cost to the program. He's a longtime service industry employee who's been vocal about his journey with sobriety. He works as the bar manager at Immigrant Sun Brewery, and he also serves as the chapter lead. If you'd like to join the conversation and have a question for Tony, you can call us 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org or tweet us. We are Sound of Ideas. Tony, I'm very excited to speak with you. You're one of those guys where the local reputation precedes you. So I've been hearing amazing things.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in.
That's a very humbling thing to hear. My reputation has been pretty terrible at points, but if it's a good one now, I'm very happy for that.
That is to be human, right?
Yeah, indeed.
All right. Tony, you've been in the service industry a long time.
Yeah, to say
the least. Right. We're aware of some of the pitfalls of the industry and how tough it can be. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what led you to this type of work? And then what makes you want to stay?
Led me to work as in the service industry?
Yeah.
I mean, I was kind of born into it. My mom, may she rest in peace, she ran a iconic restaurant from the kitchen to the front of the house called The Watermark. It's where Collision Bend now is. That was kind of like a legendary space in Cleveland for a long time right there on the river. So that kind of led me, running around that restaurant as a kid because my mom was there all the time, kind of put the desire to be around that environment, I think, in my mind as a young kid. And that was my first job. You know, I was a busser there. And kind of rose through the ranks. And I really took to it. You know, the glitz and the glamour of it, the fast pace, you know, the food, all those things was something that always really appealed to me, even at a young age. And, as I got older, it's something I thrived in. As I decided to figure out where I wanted to go with my life and what I wanted my career to look like, it made sense for it to be in the food and beverage industry. I have a lot of passion for it. And then when I was about 18, 19, I had the pleasure of waiting on Mike Simon and his wife and ended up getting a job offer with them. And I worked for Michael, his wife, and their partner, Doug, for almost 10 years. And that really even more so solidified my desire to be, you know, a member of the industry and also be a passionate member of the industry, because how could you not, you know, working next to a man like that and to a woman like that and seeing their passion and their drive and their expertise. You know, it. I have said this so many times over to staffs that I've helped cultivate and people I've worked with, and, you know, if I could take people back to that original Lola and Tremont and show them what that was like, you know, and many Clevelanders who, you know, are attached to the food scene will probably attest to that. It was such a magical, unique space. And from being a part of the staff, it just taught me such a love for, you know, food. You know, Michael would explain why we did things the way we did them and, you know, why ingredients were used with other things. And Liz had such a, you know, flair for service and how restaurant aesthetic should be. And it kind of, you know, that all got imparted to me. You know, and as I rose through the ranks with them, you know, that made me want to stay. Now, being a part of the industry, you know, that deeply and being so immersed in it was definitely something that contributed to my drinking, you know, but that was all my choice. You know, alcohol is inanimate. I chose to pick up the drink the way I did, you know, especially with having the predisposition to being an alcoholic. You know, my mother and father both had pretty severe drinking problems.
And you knew that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I make this analogy a lot. If you turn on the stove, you know that if you put your hand over the pilot, it's going to burn you. If you know that you have, you know, the predisposition to have an addiction, or, you know, that you could potentially suffer from alcoholism because your parents, your family, you may not realize that you're putting yourselves in harm's way intentionally, but in a way you are. You know, alcohol just sits there. You're the one that chooses to pick it up and drink it. And then before you know it, you then can develop an illness. You can develop a disease that does control you. You know, and that's kind of what happened to me. Actually. It's what happened to me.
Right. So let's talk about this, because I think this is going to be, you know, really important for, for some listeners out there. You know, I can get most of the journey of how you're drinking with folks after your shift. Over and you're starting to have nights that are bad and all of that. But when do you get to the point where, like, in your heart, you're going, this isn't right.
Yeah.
This is not the trajectory of my life. And I have a problem that I need to do something about, because I'm sure that was scary and confusing.
Yeah. Well, there were probably a couple defining moments of that sort of mindset. You know, I had countless empty conversations with myself looking in the mirror after long benders, going, all right, man, Monday, we're going to get our stuff together and we're going to, you know, dry out. We're going to stop drinking as much. But that Monday never came, because those conversations, I said those performatively for myself. I had no desire to stop drinking until I finally did. And I think that's a big thing of, you know, the truth of recovery or getting sober, is that you will never actually do it until you're really ready, no matter who tries to convince you or no matter how bad things get. It's not until you are absolutely ready, and whatever that looks like. But I mean, I lost my job with Mike Simon Restaurants because of my drinking, and that I never even questioned that my drinking was the problem. You know, I remember after partying like a rock star, going back to the restaurant after hours with staff, and it was a whole debaucherous, very irresponsible, very dangerous thing. And, you know, they asked me to leave the company, and rightfully so. I mean, I should have been, you know, probably well before that, because of some of the stupid things I had done. And when they asked me to leave, you know, I said, oh, you know, screw them. I'm done. I don't need that job. But no, of course I did. I needed that job. I loved that job, and I loved them as people. And as my employers, I mean, Michael and Liz are like second parents to me. But I didn't think to stop drinking then, because my drinking was part of me. It was who I was. I loved being an alcoholic. And I mean that. I thought it was so cool to be this party animal. I joked about being dependent on alcohol, and that, what a ridiculous thing, right? And then after that, there were multiple times where I probably should have drinking that I didn't really take it as seriously as I should have. And I think it wasn't until probably a good five years before I finally stopped drinking, things got really ugly, where it went from I was at the bar every night, you know, probably drinking way more than I should have, to actually having a pretty severe physical dependency, you know, where, you know, you wake up and you start shaking and sweating and dry heaving, and it's all yucky, terrible stuff.
So it's become physical.
You know, and I think a lot of people fall into that place without even really knowing it. And I think that that's you know, that's their own fault, sure, but it's also society's fault because we turn such a blind eye to alcoholism. You know, we all sit next to each other at the bar top while we're pounding down shots or drinking cocktails at a beautiful, you know, this awesome bar or emptying bottles of wine left and right. That's harmful behavior. I mean, yes, it's fun to a certain extent, but when you're doing that every single night, you're very, very quickly getting close to that physical dependency, and that becomes really, really dangerous. And that's so hard to break from as someone who had to. I mean, I had to do it through detox. I couldn't do it on my own. You can also die from that. I mean, it's a dangerous place to be, you know.
So you decide to get help, mm-hmm. and you go through detox.
Yes.
And I want to get to the point where you are sober.
Yeah.
And when did you start seeing, like, life is better? Well, and also, like, I'm going to stay in the industry.
Sure. Well, it was, you know, it was pretty early. It was pretty early on, you know, as somebody who drank as much as I did, when I removed alcohol through, you know, being able to go to Lutheran Hospital and have detox. And then I sat at home for 3.5 months. I noticed very, very quickly how much better I felt. Just physically, you know, my mental capacity started to come back. I started to have this clarity of things, which was amazing. And how could I not have latched on to that feeling as good as I did even that early on? You know, I was out to lunch with my father about 3.5 months into my sobriety, kind of, you know, what am I going to do? You know, how am I going to pay my bills? I need to get a job. I've been working since I was a kid. You know, my father looked at me and he said, well, son, if you're not going to drink, just don't drink. You know, and I said, Dad, I don't know that's that easy. If it was a matter of just don't drink, a lot less people would be struggling with their addiction. And he said, well, son, if you're telling the world, you're telling me, you're telling, you know, all your friends that you're done drinking, and most importantly, you're telling yourself, you don't really have a choice. It doesn't matter what you do professionally. You're always going to be around alcohol one way or the other. So just don't drink, son. And he was right. You know, as simple as that is, or scary as that is, or whatever, he was right, very much so. So about a week or two later, I reached out to a very longtime friend who ran a restaurant group here in Cleveland. And he said, hey, man, you can come back here. I don't know if you want to do that. I'll keep an eye on you, because he was in recovery at the time.
Nice.
He had about 9 years of sobriety.
And that's pretty key, right?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, and rightfully so, had kind of shunned me at that point. You know, I had made some pretty bonehead mistakes. I had burned more bridges than I had probably ever built through my drinking and just acting like an idiot. And I was very, very thankful that this man allowed me to come back in a space where most people weren't giving me the opportunity. So as terrifying as it was, I took a job bartending, you know, after about 4 months of sobriety. And I remember going to that first shift, and I had worked at this restaurant before. It's now closed. But I remember going, what are you doing? You're going to go back behind a bar? Like, are you sure you're ready for this?
Yeah.
And I got back behind the bar, and it wasn't a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde moment. I didn't turn into this maniac that all of a sudden wanted to pick up the bottles and start chugging booze.
Yeah.
I just went, okay, I'm not going to drink, and this is going to be okay.
And it stayed with you. All right, we got to get to Ben's friends.
Please.
I hate this, but we're already, you know,
yeah,
5 minutes away from...
I can be a little lengthy.
I love it. I can listen to you all day.
Well,
so let's talk about Ben's Friends. You're the chapter lead for this organization. What's the work that you're doing?
So Ben's Friends is a coalition of sober food and beverage people, a group, whatever you want to call it. You know, it was started in 2016 by two amazing gentlemen, Mickey and Steve. They lost a very dear friend to addiction and decided to start Ben's Friends to offer people in the food and beverage industry a place to have support. It's not a program. It's not AA. There's no 12 steps. It literally is a support group, and it is comprised primarily of people from this industry, food and beverage. You know, myself and two other gentlemen actually are the chairs. We're the co-chairs. My friend Stefan, the owner of Porco, and then our dear friend Zach. It's the three of us. It's amazing work. Almost 8 years of sobriety coming up in September. If you would have told me 8 years ago that I would be doing what I'm doing now, I would have laughed in your face and asked for another shot. So to be able to offer support to anybody, let alone support to people in the industry that I love so dearly and have been a part of since I was a very young man, is beyond humbling. you know, the men and women that come to our meeting every week are now becoming some of my dearest friends, and to share in their struggles.
You're building community.
It is. And what an amazing thing. You know, me, I didn't amount to much, you know, in my opinion, back when I was drinking my life away. You know, and when I get up in the morning now and I look in the mirror, I'm proud of myself. You know, I'm far from perfect. And I always hope to be, because I, in my opinion, that gives me opportunity to grow. So to be a part of this with these men and women and to continue to offer this space, you know, when we met at our meeting yesterday, it's continually one of my favorite days of the week because of what it brings to the table for all of us and the support it offers to the people that come. And then, you know, we have the meetings nationally, you know, every day at 1 p.m. on Zoom. You know, if you go to bensfriendshope.com, you know, the links are all on there and you can find the meeting. So it's, you know, there's 28 chapters nationally, and then there's meetings every single day via Zoom. So there's a huge community, and it's a great, great thing. And I didn't have that, and finding that in Ben's Friends has been a huge, huge thing for me.
So I can hear the emotion in your voice.
Oh, yeah.
I got to say, you're making huge impact on people, and I understand, too, garnering attention for the work that you do. How does that feel? I mean, how does that feel to be saying, hey, no, Tony Kost is making a difference and hugely influential?
I mean, it's an amazing feeling, and I will take the credit, I guess, that I'm given. It's still very hard for me to believe that somebody that was in the position I was almost 8 years ago is now somebody that people look to for strength. But if it is helping people, and here comes the emotion again, you know, I'll continue to do it. You know, I remember early on in my sobriety talking about it and seeing how it resonated with people. I've never been ashamed of being a sober person because I don't think there's anything to be ashamed about. Mm-hmm. There are so many people every single day struggling with so many things, and it's a travesty that people make them feel bad for it, especially when they don't have any control over it. So, you know,
it takes great strength.
It does.
To talk
it takes
about
so
this.
Much strength. Anybody can go out and get wasted every day. There's nothing cool about it. It doesn't make you unique. But being sober and living in this world, especially with the way the world is today, is such a powerful thing, and it makes you such a unique person. You know, your own individual sobriety is a huge, beautiful gift, not only to yourself, but the world around you. So, you know, I'm thankful for every opportunity I get to talk, platform me, whatever. I think it's really cool. You know, the intention was never to do anything other than to live my life as best as I could and change what I was doing. And apparently it resonates with people, so that's great.
Tony Kost, bar manager at Immigrant Son Brewery, as well as chapter lead for Ben's Friends. Tony, I commend you so much.
Well, thank
Thanks
you.
For coming in and speaking with me and speaking to our listeners. If you or someone you know needs help, you can always dial 988. That's the Suicide and Crisis Hotline. You can go to bensfriendshope.com. Again, Tony, thanks.
Thank you.
Time for another quick break. On the other side, we hear about best-selling author James Patterson's new book and its Northeast Ohio connection. This is The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Hamill. We'll be right back. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for spending the hour with us. James Patterson has written or co-written more than 100 New York Times bestsellers, most of them mysteries or thrillers. There's even a mystical quality to the title of his latest work, The Secret Lives of Booksellers and Librarians. It's a departure for Patterson, profiling more than 30 purveyors of literature from around the world, including Bill Kelly of the Cuyahoga County Public Library. He's the head of adult programming and also co-founder of Cleveland Book Week, which welcomes dozens of authors to the region every September. IdeaStream Public Media's Kabir Bhatia chatted with Kelly about how he caught the attention of one of the most popular authors in the world.
We hosted Jim for his tour for his memoir 2 years ago. We were fortunate enough to be chosen as one of the tour stops. And then the publisher asked me to moderate the onstage conversation, which of course is both nerve-wracking and exciting, you know, because he's the best-selling author in the world. But of course, it was an opportunity, you know, I couldn't resist. And it turned out we had a great time. I thought we had a nice rapport. I was pleasantly surprised on how funny he is, because he kind of has a sort of acerbic wit that I appreciate that comes across as a little bit intimidating sometimes to the moderator, but I think we had such a good time that at that time, this book we're talking about today was just in the very sort of seed of an idea, and asked if I'd be willing to participate in that project. Of course, I was honored. And so I'd had that initial conversation with him, and then forget how long after this, probably sometime like at least a year ago, his co-author reached out, and we had a couple extended calls where he interviewed me over the phone. And that's how it came to fruition. It was just really luck of the draw that we were hosting him, so I got to meet him. That's how he knew of me, I guess.
So then tell me the story that James Patterson basically tells in the book about how you became a librarian.
I hadn't even conceived of working in the library, even though I loved reading. I was always in the library. But no, I was a few years out of college. At that point, I'd worked in, I'll call it the music business, because that sounds cooler than it probably actually was. But out of college, I started as what they call manager in training for a company called Trans World Music. They owned all of these Coconuts and Record Towns and retail stores. By the way, this, I should say, this is mid-90s. So I see the writing on the wall of, you know, the physical format is going to give way to iTunes and so forth. So I kind of was at least aware that, all right, what's the next chapter, so to speak? And like I said, I was always in the library. And it being the mid-90s, everything was still sort of paper, like job postings on a bulletin board or on a clipboard. And I was in the library, and I just started reading it. And I thought, that sounds like me. You know, I mean, it sounds like, you know, if you have a curious nature and you're just interested in helping people find whatever information they're looking for, I'm like, that sounds perfect. Whereas I hadn't even thought of being a librarian, you know, like going back 30 years, basically, there's the sort of image of the stereotypical librarian, you know, and it really wasn't me. if you thought about the library, but of course that's all completely changed anyway. There probably really is never a stereotypical librarian. That was a public perception. But now, you know, librarians come in from every walk of life, look like everyone in the community. And so I thought, that sounds like me. And, you know, the rest is history. I think when I interviewed, having no experience in a library, I think I was at least able to articulate my passion for just lifelong learning and helping people. And that's what allowed me to get my foot in the door. It was only after I'd worked in the library for a few years that I went to library school and got my master's in information science.
So when you interviewed him, or when you interview any author, how do you approach the different events? Since a writer and their work, they can range from serious to lighthearted, and sometimes it can be a mix.
I try to make it at least interesting and entertaining while speaking to that author's sensibility. Some authors are more serious. Some authors are more literary and they want to talk about the craft. Some are more, you know, sort of plot driven authors. And, you know, you want to kind of help sell the book at the event too. And with James Patterson, you know, he's known for writing these thrillers. But also there is an intimidation factor just because, you know, he's, like I said, one of the most best-selling authors in the world. So the approach is often just to kind of bring them out to whatever their personality is, and you often don't really know what that is going in. And so I'm always pleasantly surprised when, you know, in his case, he's wanted to joke around right from the start. In fact, we had a great rapport, and in the memoir, he talks about when he was, it might have been like late high school or at least college, he worked in a mental health facility. So we're on stage and I said, so I understand you spent some time in a mental hospital, you know, and immediately it broke the ice. You know, he's laughing and he rolled with it, you know, and he talked about his experience working there, where in fact he met some famous authors, curiously enough, like the poet Robert Lowell was admitted to this hospital. So that kind of set the tone, and you can't really predict that, but it ended up being funnier because obviously he's a well-seasoned, you know, conversationalist. I find the craft fascinating. You know, when we had John Irving, for example, he writes the last sentence first. Before he does anything else, he writes the last sentence. So that was my original question was, all right, well, then what? Like, do you then just write completely backwards, or do you just then go back and fill in? Do you outline? Do you have it scripted out? E.L. Doctorow shared an anecdote when he visited. He said it's like driving at night. You can only see as far as the headlights shine, and then you move a little bit forward, and then you get a little bit more under your belt. So it is tricky. It is tricky in that you don't give away any plot points.
Okay, so without giving anything away from the book, he touches on so many aspects of being a librarian and bookselling, and you do so many things outside of the library related to literature. Tell me about Cleveland Book Week.
It all seemed like a natural progression each step of the way, because when I came into this role, we really were only very occasionally doing author events at Cuyahoga County Public Library. And we wanted to grow that to the point where now we are one of the top destinations in the country. We host about 125 authors a year on tour, from the best-selling authors to debut authors. And Writer Center Stage was another piece of that. That's our key foundation series. And I had long been friends with Karen Long, who former book editor at The Plain Dealer, and at the time she's the manager of the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards. And Cleveland Book Week came about, frankly, very organically over coffee, because our kickoff event in the fall for Writer Center Stage almost invariably fell around the same week as the Anisfield Wolf Book Awards ceremony. And I suggested we really should just come up with an umbrella branding to put over both of our events and call it Cleveland Book Week, because Karen was also doing this amazing job when all the winners would come to town for the ceremony, and then she would organize these peripheral events around in the community with those authors. And adding in the authors that I had on tour in and around that week, it seemed like this is a great way to further grow our Cleveland's literary reputation nationally.
That's our own Kabir Bhatia speaking with Bill Kelly from the Cuyahoga County Public Library. Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_, or on Instagram at @JennyHamillIdeaStream. Tomorrow on The Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with Mike McIntyre. This week, he's joined by Karen Kassler at the State House and Anna Huntsman and Zaria Johnson. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for listening, and I will speak with all of you again on Monday.